He got to his feet, ducking as he thought of whirling impeller blades just overhead. The eddies and vortices of hot, oil-filled air rocked him like a small boat bobbing in a chopping sea. He felt like a puppet controlled by a drunk. He staggered forward, his arms out, and hit Craiklin. They started to fall again, and Hawser let go, punching with all his might at the place he guessed the man's head was. His fist crashed into bone, but he didn't know where. He skipped back in case there was a retaliatory kick or punch on its way. His ears were popping, his head felt tight. He could feel his eyes vibrating in their sockets. He thought he was deaf, but he could feel a thudding in his chest and throat, making him breathless, making him choke and gasp. He could make out just a hint of a border of light all around them, as though they were under the middle of the hovercraft. He saw something, just an area of darkness on that border, and lunged at it, swinging his foot from low down. Again he connected, and the dark part of the border disappeared. He was blown off his feet by a crushing downdraft of air and tumbled bodily along the concrete, thumping into Craiklin where he lay on the ground after Hawser's last kick. Another punch hit Hawser on the head, but it was weak and hardly hurt. Hawser felt for and found Craiklin's head. He lifted it and banged it off the concrete, then did it again. Craiklin struggled, but his hands beat uselessly off Hawser's shoulders and chest. The area of lightness beyond the dim shape on the ground was enlarging, coming closer. Hawser banged Craiklin's head against the concrete one more time, then threw himself flat. The rear edge of the skirt scrubbed over him. His ribs ached, and his skull felt as though somebody was standing on it. Then it was over, and they were in the open air. The big craft thundered on, trailing remnants of spray. There was another one 50 meters down the dock, and heading toward him. Craiklin was lying still a couple of meters away. Hawser got up onto all fours and crawled over to the other man. He looked down into his eyes, which moved a little. "I'm Hawser! Hawser!" he screamed, but couldn't even hear anything himself. He shook his head, and with a grimace of frustration on the face that was not really his own, and which was the last thing the real Craiklin ever saw, he gripped the head of the man lying on the concrete and twisted it sharply, breaking the neck, just as he had broken Zalin's. He managed to drag the body to the side of the dock just in time to get out of the way of the third and last hovercraft. Its towering skirt bulged past 2 meters away from where he half lay, half sat, panting and sweating, his back against the cold, wet concrete of the dock, his mouth open and his heart thudding. He undressed Craiklin, took off the cloak and the light-coloured one-piece day suit he wore, then climbed out of his own torn blouse and bloody pantaloons and put on what Craiklin had been wearing. He took the ring Craiklin wore on the small finger of his right hand. He picked at his own hands, at the skin where palm became wrist. It came away cleanly, a layer of skin sloughing off his right hand from wrist to fingertips. He wiped Craiklin's limp, pale right palm on a damp bit of clothing, then put the skin over it, pressing it down hard. He lifted the skin off carefully and positioned it back on his own hand. Then he repeated the operation using his left hand. It was cold, and it seemed to take a very long time and a lot of effort. Eventually, while the three big air cushion vehicles were stopping and letting passengers off half a kilometre down the dock, Hawser finally staggered to a ladder of metal rungs set into the concrete wall of the dock, and with shaking hands and quivering feet, hauled himself to the top. He lay for a while, then got up, climbed the spiral stairs to the small footbridge, staggered across it and down the other side, and entered the circular access building. Brightly dressed and excited people, just off the big hovers and still in a party mood, quietened when they saw him wait near the elevator doors for the capsule, which would take them down to the spaceport area, half a kilometre under their feet. Hawser couldn't hear very much, but he could see their anxious looks, sense the awkwardness he was causing with his battered, bloody face and his ripped, soaking clothes. At last, the elevator appeared. The partygoers piled in, and Hawser, supporting himself on the wall, stumbled in too. Somebody held his arm, helping him, and he nodded thanks. They said something, which he heard as a distant rumble. He tried to smile and nod again. The elevator dropped. The underside greeted them with an expanse of what looked like stars. Gradually, Hawser realized it was the light-speckled top of a spacecraft larger than anything he'd ever seen or even heard about before. It had to be the demilitarized culture ship, the Ends of Invention. He didn't care what it was called, as long as he could get aboard and find the cat. The elevator had come to a halt in a transparent tube above a spherical reception area, hanging in hard vacuum, 100 meters under the base of the orbital. From the sphere, Walkways and tube tunnels spread out in all directions, heading for the access gantries and open and closed docks of the port area itself. The doors to the closed docks, where ships could be worked on in pressurised conditions, were all open. The open docks themselves, where ships simply moored and airlocks were required, were empty. Replacing them all, directly underneath the spherical reception area, just as it was directly underneath almost the entire port area, was the ex-Culture General Systems vehicle, the Ends of Invention.